Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sue Udry of the Defending Dissent Foundation, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the recently passed USA Freedom Act and reforms she believes are still necessary to rein in NSA surveillance programs. Climate activist Susan Rubin, who explains why there's growing opposition to a plan to expand a natural gas pipeline just over 100 feet from New York's troubled Indian Point nuclear power plant. And Jennifer Clark, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses the status of challenges to new voter suppression laws in states across the U.S. ahead of the 2016 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The migrant crisis in Southeast Asia reached a new peak when the Myanmar Navy escorted a boat full of over 700 immigrants to the western state of Rakhine, near the border of Bangladesh and the Bay of Bengal. It was feared that the boat's passengers were persecuted Muslim Rohingya people fleeing repression in Myanmar, where the government does not recognize over 1 million Muslim Rohingya as citizens. In recent weeks, the Rohingya have fled in large numbers after authorities along the Thai-Malaysia border launched a crackdown on traffickers when officials discovered mass graves of migrants. Hollywood actor Matt Dillon, who visited Rohingya refugee camps in Myanmar, declared, "This is a humanitarian situation that is caused by human beings' intolerance, fear, and unwillingness to allow other people to coexist." Nobel Prize winner and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has remained strangely silent during the ongoing migrant crisis. Currently, over 800,000 Rohingya are trapped in western Myanmar and fearful of more attacks by the majority Buddhist community. British Prime Minister David Cameron has initiated discussions with European officials with the goal of negotiating a weaker relationship with the European Union. Cameron has named a number of Tory hardliners to his negotiating committee. He is talking up the possibility of withdrawing from the European Convention of Human Rights if major concessions are not granted before the UK's 2017 referendum on altering its relationship with the EU. According to the Guardian newspaper, Cameron is backing a proposal by former Justice Minister Chris Grayling to pull out of the European Human Rights Court unless EU negotiators recognize a stronger role for the British judiciary. Cameron and the British Conservative Party want to avoid any binding ruling from the European Court of Human Rights, which would supersede Britain's Supreme Court. Although the Human Rights Convention is not formally part of the European Union, it is an important symbol of European values and despised by Eurosceptics, including backbenchers in Cameron's Conservative Party. Republican presidential hopeful Jeb Bush was the featured speaker at an early June weekend confab of top coal executives and Republican donors at an exclusive retreat in Bristol, Virginia. The hour-long speech, which was off-limits to the press, comes as coal executives and coal state politicians are in a pitched battle with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency over the final rules on carbon pollution. Energy executives and their congressional allies increasingly complain of an orchestrated war on coal. Jeb Bush was invited to the leadership retreat by six top coal executives, including Joe Kraft III of Alliance Resource Partners, Gary Drummond of Drummond Company, and John Evans of Arch Coal. During the 2012 election cycle, the six coal companies contributed over $17 million in campaign donations and lobbying. A large number of coal executives are on the record as climate change deniers, and candidate Jeb Bush is reflecting their views, despite the fact that 97% of the world's scientists disagree. At a recent New Hampshire House party, Bush lectured, quote, "I don't think the science is clear what percentage is man-made and what percentage is natural. For people to say the science is decided upon, that is just really arrogant," the Republican candidate was reported to have said. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden. Thank you.
In the congressional debate over reforming the National Security Agency's dragnet surveillance of Americans' phone communications, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's political miscalculations allowed three controversial provisions under Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act to expire on June 1st. However, the law was reinstated the next day when the Senate passed the USA Freedom Act, which the House had approved earlier. President Obama, who supported the bill, signed the USA Freedom Act into law that same day. When the Freedom Act becomes effective in 6 months, the law mandates that telecommunications companies, not the government, will store phone metadata. The legislation also demands increased transparency from the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which has been criticized as a rubber stamp in approving government access to personal phone data. Under the new law, FISA court judges will be allowed to, but not required, to appoint a friend of the court to argue on behalf of privacy concerns. Demands for reform of the NSA's bulk collection of Americans' communications were bolstered by a May 7th ruling from the Second U.S. Court of Appeals in Manhattan, which found that the program was illegal. Your reporter spoke with Sue Udry, executive director of the Defending Dissent Foundation and acting director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Here she assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the recently congressionally passed USA Freedom Act and the reform she says are still necessary to rein in the NSA's still secret surveillance programs.
So the USA Freedom Act said that no longer will the NSA be able to just get every single phone record from Verizon. It's going to have to actually narrow it down a bit and just ask Verizon about certain records that they say have to do with a terror investigation. So it means the records will be, your phone records will be kept with the phone company, which is where they ordinarily are kept, and that the NSA has to identify some reason why they want to get a particular set of records. It is a bit of a restriction. It's not nearly as strong as we want. But there were a lot of other things that advocates were speaking in order to reform not just the NSA's bulk collection, but also the way the FISA court operates and a few other transparency issues.
So given the fact that many civil liberties activists around the country are dissatisfied with what the USA Freedom Act did not feature in the legislation, what is the reform agenda now? What are some of the things that you and your organization and allies will be focused on? I've been reading about Section 702 of the FISA Amendment Act and something called Executive Order 12333.
Right. There are so many different authorities that the intelligence agencies are using to circumvent the Fourth Amendment that we need to look at those two in particular. Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act is really the NSA is allowed to and supposed to go look around the world outside of U.S. borders and see if there are any threats. And what they do, what they're doing is scooping up all sorts of internet communications. And they're allowed to do that. Our Constitution doesn't protect people outside of our borders. But in the process of scooping up all these communications and data on the internet, the NSA is, quote, inadvertently also scooping up the communications and data of U.S. persons. And right now, U.S. intelligence agencies and law enforcement are allowed to query all the data that the NSA collects and get information about U.S. persons. And so what the civil liberties community writ large wants to do is close that back door. It's called the back door because it's kind of a backdoor way for law enforcement to get at data that they don't have a legal right to see. So that's a really big one. You know, actually, what's top on our agenda is to even understand what are all the mass surveillance programs or all the surveillance programs that don't conform to the Fourth Amendment that U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies are using. We don't even know, and we keep getting trickles of information coming out. So what we're demanding is a new church committee, that Congress actually stop and take an audit, really, of all the surveillance programs that are going on inside the country so that they can get a handle on what effect this is having on our privacy and our civil liberties.
Sue Udry, not all that long ago, just before the key portions of the USA Patriot Act were about to expire, the Second Circuit Federal Court ruled that Section 215 in the surveillance we've been talking about was unauthorized, illegal. They did not rule it was unconstitutional, but I think that led many in Congress and around the country to really think hard about the revelations that Edward Snowden made and why he made them. Do you feel the process we've seen unfold, both in terms of public debate and laws passed in Congress, including this USA Freedom Act, is a vindication of Edward Snowden and his decision to release this heretofore secret material?
Well, absolutely. Without Edward Snowden, we would not have had this debate. Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act has sunset every 2 years since it was first passed. And so Congress has had to reauthorize it 7 times already. And every time that they go to reauthorize it, you know, civil liberties groups say, no, we don't know what's going on with this. It's way too broad. You can't reauthorize it. But they go ahead and reauthorize it anyway. And so after the Snowden revelations, well, we knew what we could point to evidence that the law was being abused. And people from across the political spectrum, across the country, weighed in. And we had massive outpouring, especially in the last 2 weeks, of emails and phone calls and letters going into Congress demanding that Section 215 not be just reauthorized. And some groups were calling for USA Freedom as a first step toward reform, and other groups like ours were saying, no, let's just sunset 215 and let's not pass USA Freedom. But nonetheless, it was an actual debate, which hasn't really happened before. So, yes, a huge vindication of Snowden.
That was Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Defending Dissent Foundation and Acting Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. For more perspectives on reforming NSA surveillance programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Grassroots groups all over the U.S. are fighting proposals for new or expanded frack gas pipelines. In the last week of May, about 200 people protested outside the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, demanding that the industry-funded agency stop approving all pending permits for pipelines, compressor stations, gas storage facilities, and gas export terminals until the agency is completely reformed. One of the participants in the protest at FERC in Washington, D.C. was Susan Rubin, who lives in Chappaqua, New York, just a few miles from the Indian Point nuclear power plant. FERC recently approved the Spectra Energy Company's proposal to double the capacity of a high-pressure natural gas pipeline to a 46-inch diameter that runs just 100 feet from the nuclear power plant. Indian Point, which was the site of a recent transformer fire, is considered by many opponents to be the most dangerous nuclear plant in the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Susan Rubin in Washington, D.C., where both were participating in Beyond Extreme Energy's protest action called Stop the Furcus. Here, Rubin explains why she believes a large gas pipeline located so close to an operating nuclear power plant poses a serious danger to millions of residents of the greater New York City area, and the efforts that are now being made to raise public awareness and build opposition.
I was surprised to find out there actually is an existing gas pipeline underneath the Indian Point nuclear plant, which is 25 miles north of New York City. But last year, I discovered that Spectra Energy was going to run a 42-inch high-pressure gas pipeline, 105 feet, a new pipeline. Part of the Algonquin extension AIM, part of the AIM project, and FERC has approved it at this point.
So there was already a pipeline under the nuke plant.
Yes. It was built in 1952, and I was shocked as you are to discover this. The gas pipeline in San Bruno, California, that exploded in 2010, that incinerated 38 homes, was of the same size. I think it was like a 20-inch, something like that. So this is going to be 42-inch, which is a whopper of a pipeline. And keep in mind that Indian Point has over 40 years of radioactive waste, what they like to call spent fuel on site, along with millions of gallons of fuel to run backup generators in case there's a power outage. So all of these things are potentially catastrophic for the New York City metropolitan area, because Indian Point is only 25 miles north of Midtown Manhattan, and there are 20 million people in the 50-mile zone around Indian Point. I think it's 13% of the population of the United States lives within 50 miles of Indian Point. So these pipelines are a real weak link in our system. The pipeline was grandfathered in, but right now in the United States, there is no other situation where a pipeline this big is in this kind of proximity to a nuclear power plant. This is really a unique situation, and it seems to me that the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, like FERC, is very industry friendly, and there have not been any independent studies of, you know, the potential dangers of this pipeline nuke plant combination.
Do you know, was there a full environmental impact study done of this proposed pipeline, and what happened?
The interesting thing is that NRC supplied to FERC their study of safety for this, and what NRC did was they had Entergy, which is the corporation that owns Indian Point, do their own study. And, of course, Entergy's study said that, oh, no, this does not pose any risk whatsoever to site a pipeline so close. We do have a couple of people that are experts in the field who disagree and are speaking loudly, one of whom is Paul Blanche, who is a nuclear engineer. And surprisingly, Mr. Blanche is typically pro-nuke and also pro-gas. And he is deeply concerned about this combination, and he is doing everything he possibly can. And he's accused the NRC of some really strong things, like the fact that they really underestimated the blast radius of a 42-inch pipeline at whatever PSA. This is like physics, but, you know, you don't have to be a physicist to understand that a large pipeline, high pressure, methane is highly explosive.
You said this Mr. Blanche, the nuclear engineer, is speaking out. But what about, you live nearby, you live close, but even people in New York City, are people organizing around this?
Well, fortunately, the SANE Energy Project in New York City, they are trying to get the word out. But in general, it's really interesting because people in New York City somehow think that Indian Point is upstate, and it's really not. It's a 30 to 40-minute train ride. It is not that far away. So that's part of, I feel like I am a Paul Revere, and I am trying to do everything I can to just get the word out about this, because our media in the New York City metro area doesn't cover any news related to this pipeline. Most people are completely unaware that this pipeline project is happening.
Well, that seems to fit into the whole what FERC is all about. Nobody's ever heard of FERC either. And there are people, you and I are down here at FERC in Washington, D.C. There's been protests all week, and we've been talking and passing out literature to passersby and to employees. What do you think the best pressure point is? You know, should we be in front of FERC? Should we be at Congress? Should we be picketing the industry? We've done a few different things. Different people have done different things, but so far, it's been a real uphill battle. I mean, things keep getting approved, and it seems like, you know, they're just flicking us away.
Well, I am in agreement with both Ralph Nader and Paul Blanche, who say what we need to do is we need to activate 1% of the population. And once we get that, we will create a tipping point.
That was climate activist Susan Rubin, who's fighting the increased capacity of a gas pipeline near the Indian Point nuclear power plant in Buchanan, New York. Find more information on opposition to the pipeline and FERC's expansion of natural gas projects nationwide by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since the 2010 midterm election, 21 states, most of them controlled by the Republican Party,
have passed an assortment of new laws that make it harder for specific groups of citizens to vote. 14 states will have new voting restriction laws in place for the first time in a presidential election in November 2016. These measures include restrictive voter ID laws, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, and obstacles placed on registering new voters and accessing absentee ballots. While Republican lawmakers assert new limits on voting rights have been introduced to prevent voter fraud, independent analysis has found no evidence to support their claim. The flood of new regulations disenfranchising voters followed the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling, which gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Many civil liberties and civil rights groups have long charged that the drive to make voting more difficult disproportionately affects minority voters and is part of a strategy to gain partisan political advantage for the GOP. In a recent speech, former U.S. Senator, Secretary of State, and current presidential candidate Hillary Clinton called out Republicans for their sweeping effort to disempower and disenfranchise people of color, poor people, and young people from one end of our country to the other. Clinton is now advocating the adoption of universal and automatic voter registration. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, as of May 13th this year, at least 113 bills that would restrict access to registration and voting have been introduced or carried over in 33 states. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Clark, counsel with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, who discusses the status of challenges to new voter suppression laws in states across the nation ahead of the 2016 presidential election.
The type of restrictions that have been passed range from some states have severely rolled back their early voting. So they used to offer, you know, a couple weeks of it, and now they offer less than that. Sometimes they used to have weekend hours, which are incredibly popular, and particularly popular among the African-American community, because there's sort of this soul to the polls movement where people tend to go to vote after church. And in a lot of states, Sunday early voting has been eliminated or is only offered on a discretionary basis. So we've seen cutbacks to early voting. We've seen some states, such as North Carolina, which is one of the states that used to be covered under the part of the Voting Rights Act, was gutted a couple years ago. They have eliminated the opportunity to register and vote in one trip, which they used to do. And that helped turn out hugely because people who have moved recently and haven't updated their address, people who simply were not up to date on the registration deadlines, which can sometimes be, you know, 21, 28 days ahead of the election, they were still able to go in and cast a ballot that counted. They can't do that in North Carolina anymore and in other states that are eliminating same-day registration. And a big one that has gotten a lot of attention is the institution of strict photo ID laws. So states such as Texas, another state that used to be covered by the Voting Rights Act, have instituted extremely strict photo ID laws that only let you show a small number of documents, or you can't cast a ballot. That's really your only choice. So those are the range of restrictions that we've seen. And, you know, there's plenty of experts at work in litigation across the country who are attempting to estimate how many people. So I don't have a number for nationwide. We do know that it has affected almost half of the states. People in 21 states, they were facing more voter restrictions when they went to the polls in 2014 than when they went to the polls in 2010.
Review for us the fights ahead of the 2016 presidential election to roll back some of these new restrictions on voting.
Sure. There are some court cases that are currently pending that could have a resolution prior to the 2016 election. So we may see some of those restrictions that we were just talking about rolled back. In Texas, there is a case against the voter ID law that is currently before an appellate court, and they are likely to issue a decision on it this summer, and it could go up to the Supreme Court, or is quite likely to go up to the Supreme Court next year, and they could pass judgment on that before the 2016 election. So we could have an answer on strict photo ID before then. There's also a case in North Carolina against the host of restrictions that they put in place after the Voting Rights Act was gutted, and that is going to have a trial this July. So there are certainly cases that are moving through the courts. There are some cases, such as one in Ohio, that are at much earlier stages and are unlikely to reach the Supreme Court before the 2016 election. But anything is possible. Before the 2014 election, we saw a huge flurry of quick appeals up to the Supreme Court and back down. So these are court cases to definitely watch. And all the action isn't just happening in the courts. We also have to keep an eye on the legislature. There is a bipartisan-backed Voting Rights Amendment Act that was introduced in Congress last year. But, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like our legislators are really paying attention. They don't really seem to be grasping the necessity to get some of these protections back in place. So we can hope that Congress will actually act on that next year.
Recently, Democratic presidential candidate, former Secretary of State, former Senator and First Lady Hillary Clinton has expressed support for expanding the right to vote. And at the same time, her campaign has launched lawsuits in several key states in the coming election to try and fight back against some of these restrictive voting laws. What kind of effect do you think that might have on the scene here in terms of what the outcome could be before the 2016 election?
It was certainly very exciting to see a top political leader get on stage and talk so passionately about expanding access to the ballot. She happens to be a Democratic politician, but if you look to the states, there's no reason that we can't see people reaching across the aisle and working this out, because in the past legislative session, we saw states that, you know, would not be considered your more liberal states. Oklahoma passed voting reform that makes it easier for people to register by being able to do it completely online. We saw bipartisan support in Vermont for a bill that allows people to register at the polls on election day. That was supported by Democrats and Republicans in Vermont alike. So I think that there's a model for bipartisan work on voting reform, and it's happening in the states. I hope our national politicians can recognize that and follow suit.
That was Jennifer Clark, counsel with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Learn more about groups fighting voter suppression laws by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.